Now Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence C. Spivak. Four of America's top reporters are ready for this spontaneous, unrehearsed conference. Here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. The negotiations over Berlin resume this week. If they break down again, the West may be confronted with a serious military problem. These questions are being asked. Will there be another airlift? Should we send military convoys into Berlin? Our guest today is General Maxwell Taylor, who has just resigned as Chief of Staff of the Army. He was in command in Berlin during the last airlift, and he is recognized as one of the best informed men on our military posture in that area. General Taylor also served as Commander-in-Chief of the United Nations Forces in Korea. He was the Army Chief of Staff for 4 years. His total service in the Army is 41 years. He steps out at a time when all of our forces are undergoing a reexamination and a reappraisal. In resigning, General Taylor said his decision was partly prompted by his limited success in trying to modernize the Army. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview General Taylor, are Richard Wilson of the Coles Publications, Yates McDaniel of the Associated Press, Roscoe Drummond of the New York Herald Tribune, and Lawrence E. Spivak, a regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, General Taylor, if you're ready, sir, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
General Taylor, when you were in Berlin, West Berlin, several months ago, this is what you said. The United States is in nothing more united than in its determination to keep West Berlin free. Does that, in your judgment, mean that you believe we are prepared to go to war rather than abandon West Berlin?
I would say that our country has committed itself publicly without reservation to maintaining the freedom of 2.5 million West Berliners. I don't know precisely what that will mean in terms of our reaction, but I would say we can't compromise with that commitment.
General, Mr. Harriman quoted Prime Minister Khrushchev as saying this: your generals talk of maintaining your position in Berlin with force. That's a bluff. What do you think we ought to do to convince Mr. Khrushchev that we're not bluffing?
I think we have to act in consistence with that conviction that any price is worth paying if Berlin is truly in danger. I would point out, of course, that the generals do not decide these matters. They will be determined by our responsible civilian leadership.
General, the New York Times recently quoted you as saying, before the Senate Preparedness Subcommittee, Berlin can be defended, and in my judgment, it must be defended. And then in a later story, the New York Times quote you as saying that Berlin itself was militarily untenable. Now that sounds like a contradiction. Can you tell us if you were accurately quoted, and if so, what that meant?
Yes, I think that's an accurate quote. I would say that Berlin as an island 100 miles inside the Iron Curtain, as a specific spot on the Earth's surface, is indefensible by the means available to it inside the city. But when we look at the resources the United States and the free world has outside of Berlin, I would say we have adequate means to protect our position.
One more question, General. As a military commander, knowing Soviet superiority and ground forces, if a war does start in Berlin, would we have any choice but to use our most powerful weapons, the H-bombs?
I would always say we should use just the force necessary to the situation. The last thing we would ever want to do is embark on general atomic war. I think we have many responses short of that. Whether they would be sufficient or not, only history would tell.
Mr. Drummond.
General, everyone knows from what you've said that on many occasions that you're not entirely happy about our total military posture. And you have reservations about the functioning of the Joint Chiefs. Now, I remember recently, for example, that the House Committee on Appropriations, discussing the 1960 budget, made this statement: the Joint Chiefs of Staff as a body is not providing the kind of advice and leadership the country requires. I'd like to ask whether you consider that a fair and significant criticism, and what you think ought to be done to correct it.
Well, first, before I would agree to any criticism of the Joint Chiefs, Mr. Drummond, I would first point out I've been one of them, and I share in the criticism directed at the body. I frequently think that the chiefs are criticized for things which they really are guiltless of. For example, we forget that the Joint Chiefs are a committee and can do no more or no less than a good committee can do. In other words, they can form broad-term policies in which the time factor is not important and where a unanimity of opinion is not essential. But to expect the chiefs to be unanimous, I would say, is unfair to them. And perhaps it would be a very bad news to the country if the word got out, the chiefs agree on everything. There's no danger of that, fortunately.
Well, you yourself said in testifying before Congress a while ago, and I quote, "I think that our weakness," meaning the JCS, is in not determining standards of sufficiency. We never look at the problem as a whole and determine whether each function is properly supported. Now, I ask as a layman in complete sincerity, if not, why not?
It is partially the fault of the Joint Chiefs that we have not strongly recommended developing the defense budget so that we buy not an army, a navy, and an air force as more or less separate vertical entities, but rather we buy an atomic deterrent force to which several services contribute, to continental air defense forces to which several services contribute. As I say, the Joint Chiefs couldn't affect that change by themselves, but they can recommend it. But it would require a fundamental change in our bookkeeping and our budget making, both in the Pentagon, in the executive branch of the government, and in Congress also. Well,
are there any one or two changes in the operation or the functioning of the Joint Chiefs that you would recommend?
Yes, I would separate out those functions which can be dealt with by committee methods. And I would leave those functions with the Joint Chiefs of Staff as a committee. I think then there are many operational type functions which cannot be dealt with by a committee, and a different arrangement should be made in the Joint Staff itself.
Mr. McDaniel.
General, you have recently retired from active service, is certainly not on account of years and age. Apparently at the very peak of your influence and when you're making your voice heard, why did you step down when you did?
Well, Mr. McDaniel, as you can imagine, there are a variety of reasons, many of them personal, some perhaps official. But I would say that in the 4 years I was Chief of Staff, I pressed as hard as I could to obtain a thorough reappraisal of our national military strategy. I was only partially successful. I feel that in 4 years I have done all I can as a part of the defense team in this direction. I now go out and perhaps I can contribute from the outside.
General Taylor, just a few days ago in your farewell speech to Press Club, you warned of the dangers of advice by military alumnus, I believe you said. Why is it you think you can do more outside of the service than you can inside?
I don't necessarily think I can, Mr. McDaniel, but I think there is, in the freshness of experience, the possibility of making a contribution in this direction. I will try not to be that ill-informed old alumnus who is definitely a danger.
Did you ever take your point of view, your desire or belief, in fact, very strong conviction for an overall reappraisal, did you ever take that up to the president?
Not in that particular form, but throughout 4 years, I have defended the requirement for this reappraisal in the Joint Chiefs of Staff and before two Secretaries of Defense.
I think you dodged the question just a little bit. Did you ever put this business up to the president, who is, after all, commander-in-chief?
My immediate superior is the Secretary of Defense, and he is the man I carry my problems to directly. Only in rare instances is it proper to carry them to the president.
Did you ever see the president on talk business At his request or upon your...
Oh, yes.
...request?
On frequent occasions.
Did he ever take your advice?
Yes.
Because recently you have talked about the Army not doing so well, not getting the modernization. In fact, during your 4 years as Chief of Staff, and in fact during your predecessor's regime, it appears that the presence of a professional soldier in the White House has made it a little more difficult for the Army to put across its position. Do you share that opinion?
No, I would not share that opinion in those terms. I would point out also the Army has made definite progress in the last 4 or 6 years. Not as far, perhaps, as I would like to have gone with this program, but I don't want to give the impression I'm leaving because of discouragement in the slightest.
Mr. Wilson.
General Taylor, I wonder if the question with respect to Berlin, in view of the analyses you have made in the past of the state of readiness of the Army, I wonder if the problem there is not whether we should go in case the crisis really rises, but whether if we go in, we can be effective. Have the policies which have been adopted in the past few years made us weaker with respect to a situation like Berlin?
If you mean, Mr. Wilson, that to ask the question whether or not we have failed to develop our conventional forces on a par with equal effort as with our general war forces, I would agree with your question. I would not say, however, that should make us hesitant as to what we should do in Berlin. I've been in enough crises to know that when the cards are down at a critical time, you have to move forward and throw your fears over your shoulder. I would have that attitude toward Berlin.
Well, this is really the point I'm getting at. I think that perhaps your point of view on that is widely shared in the government and certainly also in the executive part of the government and also in Congress. But the point I'm trying to get at is whether or not the policies which have been adopted put us in a disadvantageous position with respect to doing what we ought to do in Berlin.
Of course, that will depend upon the situation posed to us in Berlin. I would agree again with what your implied statement that we are not strong across the board. We've given emphasis in certain areas of preparation without complete balance elsewhere. And it's to correct that imbalance that I think we should direct our efforts in the future months and years.
Well, on that point, when the current budget was sent to Congress, I believe you and the other members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff signed a statement which said, in effect, that although you thought there should be some additional appropriations for your individual services, that at the same time, this budget was adequate to protect the security of the United States at the time. That's correct.
That is not quite accurate, Mr. Wilson. What the statement was that the sum of some $41 billion, the sum, should be sufficient this year. It did not endorse the exact composition or the organization of this budget.
No, but it said the overall budget was adequate to the security of the United States.
The overall sum of money available was adequate.
Well, if there was any doubt about Berlin or about a similar situation elsewhere in the world, why would any member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff ever sign such a statement?
I think because we say that we have resources which are applicable to this situation, it all depends upon how rapidly it comes and a variety of other factors which can never be predicted. We could never afford, Mr. Wilson, or I'm sure you would not recommend, that we have ready all the time, all the military forces to meet all conceivable crises taking place concurrently. Necessarily, we have to accept certain risks in our calculation.
But in the case of Berlin, there always has been a threat.
That is correct. It's been with us for years.
Was there any pressure brought on you to sign this statement by the Secretary of Defense, the President, or anybody else?
No, I don't sign under pressure, Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Spivak.
General, you seem to have been dissatisfied with the budget and the Army strength during all your years as Chief of Staff. Why did you wait until recently to publicly vent your dissatisfaction?
I don't know that I did, Mr. Spivak. I have never believed that chiefs of staff should get on platforms and talk against the decisions of their civilian leaders. That's not the way we operate the business, nor should we. I have not said anything in the last year which I have not said repeatedly before. I do think there has been more publicity given this year to testimony in executive session of Congress than before. So perhaps there's been more repercussion of these statements. But I have not changed my views, nor have I changed the emphasis in expressing those.
General, in going to the public in the past, haven't you really suggested pretty strongly, though, that you were satisfied? I remember some statements of yours in 57 and in 56 indicating that you were not dissatisfied with your budget or with the state of the preparation of the Army.
I think that you will find that each year that after the Secretary of Defense and the President had approved the budget, I made no effort to attack that budget, nor should I have done so. On the other hand, in my testimony before Congress, I have been very frank with the impact of this budget on four different occasions, four different years. And in all those appearances, I have shown the downward trend in the readiness of the Army.
Well, after a budget was set, was there any pressure brought upon you to defend those budgets? Because in public statements, General, I have several of them here, you seem to at least have defended those budgets. For example, in 57, when you were asked a question on another news program, do you think that your budget of $9.7 billion is enough to keep up the Army and to provide for the modernization of the Army? You said, yes, I would have liked to have had more. But I have the budget now, which I definitely think will allow the Army to progress, and I'm satisfied with it. Now, was pressure brought to you once the budget was made?
Only the ethics of conduct expected of any chief of staff, and which should be expected, namely once the decision is taken by responsible civilian leadership, that it should be supported.
Well, now, General Ridgway, who was your predecessor, was also dissatisfied, and he went on public record, I believe, before you became chief of staff and after you became chief of staff. Fact is that at one time he wrote, "The fact is the 1955 budget was a directed verdict, as were the Army budgets for 56 and 57. The force levels provided in all three were not primarily based on military needs." Now, did you at that time disagree with General Ridgway?
I believe that statement of General Ridgway is in his book, which he wrote after leaving the position
of
chief of staff.
That's right. It's Saturday Evening Post articles, too.
Yes.
Were you in disagreement with those direct...
No,
were they directed budgets?
I respect General Ridgway's statement. I'm sure that he stated the case as he saw it.
They were directed budgets, then?
I accept his statement. I do not know that.
Well, now, but they were, some of those budgets were, when you came in, 56 and 57, weren't those budgets
your budget?
Of course,
Mr. Spivak, in a sense, all these budgets have been directed by certain guidelines, both as to dollars and as to manpower. There's been no question about that.
Do you think the present method of making up the military budget is a satisfactory one,
General? No, I do not.
Well, what would you do?
I would pursue the point which was raised in the previous discussion. Namely, not to budget by armies, navies, and air forces, but rather by functional types of operational forces. Then you know what you're buying. We don't know now.
Oh, Mr. Drummond.
General, what are one or two of the major specific points at which you would correct the budget in order to achieve your view of a balanced force?
Well, take the easiest one. For illustration purposes, the composition of the atomic retaliatory force. That consists of the heavy bombers of the Air Force and will soon include its long-range missiles. It also includes the long-range aircraft of the Navy. It also includes the tactical air forces disposed in Europe or in the Far East. Altogether, the strength of those units in the aggregate represent our atomic deterrent effect. We never cost by them. Ask ourselves, how much money are we putting into that particular combination of forces, and is that the right percentage in terms of the emphasis which we should place?
Well, I'd like to ask you this related question then, and that is, Are you satisfied to accept, or do you consider it a sound policy for this government to accept a 3-to-1 disadvantage with respect to the Soviet Union in intercontinental missiles, as we appear to be doing, or indeed as we are doing?
No, I think we definitely should press harder in the missile field. I've always felt we have been overly conservative in getting out of the manned aircraft
disadvantage of 3-to-1 if we're going to rely less on manned bombers. Is that correct?
That is correct. We should the transition period should be contracted just as much as possible.
Mr. McDaniel.
In that testimony before the House Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, you remarked on this same line, you made such comments that our atomic bang, if you want to call it, is excessive, overwhelming, used a number of phrases and terms. You also indicated that we should have about atomic or nuclear weapons to attack or destroy targets numbering in the hundreds, whereas we actually had thousands. Do you mean to say that we have 10 times too much nuclear retaliatory power today?
If we add up all the delivery vehicles, all of these aircraft and missiles of the Navy, of the Air Force, of our tactical air forces, and of our allies, we do indeed have a very impressive number, a number which I would consider excessive. In other words, in the immediate present and the near future, that is the case. As we look farther down the road, that is not necessarily true.
Well, right now, I don't want to get two issues mixed. The one committee of Congress is looking into undue influence upon military procurement by retired military officers. And in the same line, the president said recently in answer to a question that something beside the strict military needs of the country partly shapes the choice of weapon systems. Is there any other influence that you can put your finger on that has led to this situation where we have as much as 10 times too much in one line that you think 10
times
too much?
No, I think it goes back to the way we budget. We don't know exactly what we've got in some of these categories, and we're never quite sure where the gaps or the incompletely covered areas are. I think by our very change in the budgeting process, much of this could be corrected.
General, you've taken part and you've read a lot about various new looks and reappraisals. What do you all do on these reappraisals and new looks if you don't look at how much destructive power and military power you've got on hand?
I don't know of any reappraisal since 1953.
And that nobody's looked at all these vast number of atomic weapons that we're building up and means of delivering them since 1953?
Well, I would say there's been a great deal of discussion of the subject, but nothing really has been
done about it. No one stops it. Well, what keeps it going that way, then, building up so much?
Well, I would say military programs have a certain momentum that carries them forward. It's like the missile makers, that they move by inertial guidance.
Mr. Wilson.
General Taylor, I think you skipped over one phase of a previous question that I would be interested in hearing you speak on. It has been stated that there are perhaps 300 cases of possible conflict of interest growing out of the jobs taken by former military officers with the concerns doing defense business with the government. Now, you as chief of staff of the Army, do you know of any cases, or did you suspect any cases in which undue influence was brought by any of these officers to show favoritism to the companies they worked for?
Mr. Wilson, I can say in all honesty that never in my period as chief of staff or in any other position in the Army have I seen a retired officer try to exert influence on his active colleagues. It just doesn't take place as I've observed it. And furthermore, knowing the reaction of men in uniform to that kind of conduct, I would say there'd be at least two strikes against any retired officer who tried it.
No retired officer ever came to you?
Never.
To plead a special case?
Never.
Let me get back to the appropriations for a second, General Taylor. Do you see in the future a steadily declining sum for the Army?
Based on my experience in four budgets, I would say we're going to get 23% of the next the 1961 budget and possibly of the 1962. I don't know.
What will that be in dollars?
Well, it all depends upon what the ceiling is allowed. We've been running around 41 to 42 billion.
Well, this is a decrease, is it? This
no, budget? That's. I'm just making the point that the percentage-wise, the budget allocation between the services has all has varied not more than 1 or perhaps 2%.
Oh, I'm not talking about as between the services. I'm talking about the exact sum. I'm talking about whether or not the emphasis on ground warfare is going to decline in the future as it has declined in the past.
I would say that we're going to get the same relative amount of whatever defense budget is authorized. I think there will be a slight increase in defense budgets because the past indicates a slight upward trend. But I see nothing in the future that leads me to hope that the Army will get the sum such as $13 billion, which I have said is necessary for 5 years to modernize the Army.
Mr. Spivak.
General, you and the President seem in conflict over the size of the Army. What's your answer to the President's question, which he recently put about more troops? Where will I put them?
I can't comment on that, Mr. Spivak. We have several garrison posts, however, that are not entirely occupied.
Well, the President also said, well, just some place where it is nice to keep them out of the way because I don't know what else to do with them. Would you have known what to do with troops?
Yes, we have just lost one of our four Strategic Army Corps Division because of lack of military personnel. The first step, of course, would be to build up the Strategic Army Corps and also to replace foreign nationals occupying military spaces abroad.
Is the answer then that you would know where to put them?
I think I could find a place, Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Drummond.
General, what is your attitude toward ending nuclear tests on the assumption of adequate inspection?
Well, when you say on the assumption of adequate inspection, you really pose the real problem, don't
that,
you? I can hardly conceive of adequate inspection as I know the Soviet reaction. But even with adequate inspections, we'd be very unfortunate if we stopped the testing of very small yield weapons, a point which was made on the program last week.
Mr. Wilson?
The President has also said, General Taylor, that we'll never fight a ground war over Berlin. Why do you need all these forces if that's the case?
Well, I would suspect there may be challenges other than Berlin if we are indeed not going to fight a ground war.
Do you agree with him on that point?
I cannot predict the future, Mr. Wilson.
I think at this point, gentlemen, I'll have to interrupt. I see that our time is running short. Thank you very much, General Taylor, for being with us.
Monitor's thanks to the Meet the Press cast and to its guest, General Maxwell Taylor, former Chief of Staff. Meet the Press, produced by Lawrence C. Spivak. And now a personal word, if I may. How much do you really know about your children's other home, the place where they spend a good third of each day, their school? Is it good enough to make the most of their abilities? Does it give them a head start in life, or does it hold them back? How does it stand up with other schools? These are important questions. You can have the answers to them in a free booklet condensing recommendations of Dr. James B. Conant, President Emeritus of Harvard. The booklet is titled, Dr. Conant Looks at American High Schools. It's based on his recent 2-year study of our schools and contains his specific recommendations to school boards and citizens. It tells what your children should be getting in a first-rate high school and how you can help make sure they do. It's a booklet that should be in the hands of every parent in America and in the hands of every citizen who knows the need for better elementary and high schools. For your free copy, write the words, American High Schools Booklet, on a card or letter, and mail it to Better Schools, 9 East 40th Street, New York 16, New York. 9 East 40th Street, New York 16, New York. And thanks. There's 5 minutes of news coming up, then monitor continues, but for me for this week,